There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
20 years ago, a few people anywhere in the world had heard of probiotics, known as good bacteria. They're said to restore the bacterial balance in your gut to healthy levels and have exploded in popularity in the last two decades. However, is that bubble about to be exploded in itself and burst? Because researchers at Weizmann Institute of Science have labelled probiotics quite useless after testing a homemade probiotic cocktail on 25 healthy volunteers. Known as good bacteria, they're said to restore the bacterial balance in your gut to healthy levels. However, may not be as universally beneficial for gut health as previously thought. Let's get the thoughts now of a friend of the show, friend of the station, in fact. He's back here in our new studios for the first time, making his debut here on The Agenda and in our new home, rehabilitation and performance coach who specialises in pain relief movement, energy digestion. Keith Littlewood is with us. Keith, thanks for your time this morning, my friend.
Good morning, Tom. Good to be in these flash studios.
They are a bit flash, aren't they? A bit open to the elements, as it
nice
were.
Nice and bright.
The elements of the other radio stations as well. Can't hide away from them and their antics nowadays. But I want to get your thoughts on this. We called you in because I can't think of anyone better to have a chat about this and other stories that are coming out in the world of digestion, health and lifestyle. Let's start with the P word, if we can. Probiotics. Is there anything in this research at the moment about their efficacy?
Well, I haven't actually seen that study, but something that actually struck me straight away that you have to look at is a relatively small study on 25 people. And there are honestly lots of variables when you come to look at a study like this. What's the person eating? What's their kind of previous health? What stuff have they acquired over their lifetime? The thing is, there's actually quite a lot of research on probiotics, and it's very, very mixed. For example, one of the most benefits of probiotics is if you have something like diarrhea or a food bug, taking probiotics seems to restrict the amount of time that you're sick for a couple of days. But things with ulcerative colitis and other and bacterial infections, it seems to be very, very mixed. The problem is sometimes that the bacteria that you get in can be come from different sources. Food can actually happen like to be a very good antibacterial action as well. So when we come to say something is good or bad, there are so many variables that we need to kind of accept within the study that are confounding factors or not. With regards to probiotics, good bacteria can be good to a certain degree, but even high levels of good bacteria can cause problems as well. Mm. A lot of the research goes back to the 1906 or 1908 Nobel Science Prize winner, a guy called Eli Metchnikoff, who did so many studies, and he said that he found with a lot of animals, the less bacteria you have in the gut, generally the more beneficial. But he found that tribes and societies that drank kind of fermented milks and products like this, because it had high lactobacillus, which is the common thing that you tend to find in the yogurts and that they tend to have a better digestion and seem to have longer lifespans. Now, we can't actually attribute drinking bacterial foods for longer lifespans. They may have had much more active lifestyle. There might have been different nutrients in the area. But he found that animals that had less bacteria generally lived longer lives. So if you looked at birds, if you looked at your kind of hunter animals that ate a lot of meat, they tend to have less bacteria. But if you look at cows, for example, that have four stomachs that need to break down cellulose, they produce so much bacteria and they live much less lives.
When you reference history such as that, and we can chart it back to the very beginnings of mankind, if you like, is that literally a million and some years ago from where we are today with the sort of rise of commercial brands? Because a lot of us will think of good bacteria these days and think of a little shiny bottle of Yakult that's in our fridge or something like that.
Exactly.
Do we need to get the definitions right these days to work forward with good bacteria per se?
Well, I work with a lot of people with digestion issues around the world, and I often find keeping bacterial overgrowths and end products of bacteria down to a minimum is something that needs to be done rather than trying to keep repopulating bacteria. And there's even studies that show that when you put probiotics into someone's system, even when you've been taking them for a couple of weeks, they'll return to the person's normal levels anyway. We know that there are certain bacteria that are bad and that do cause problems. We know that some bacteria seem to be beneficial, but to what extent, we're not really sure. As I said, the studies are very, very mixed. Mm.
We are in conversation with our friend, Keith Littlewood, who's here in the studio. He's a rehabilitation performance coach who specialises in pain relief movement, energy digestion. We wanted to get Keith in because we wanted a voice of reason, and he is that voice of reason. When it comes to all things digestion, when it comes to all the research that Joe, myself and the rest of the team down here are bombarded with on a daily basis. I'm sure Keith is as well to a certain degree with regards to a variety of subjects. But it seems to me, Keith, that it is food products and food in general that we get so much contrary research on all the time. One minute margarine's bad for you, the next thing it's the elixir for eternal life. Probiotics, the latest thing as well. Everyone used to swear by them. Now we've got research saying that they could be quite useless. How do you balance those opposing opinions?
Well, sometimes you have to look at the history and the bias behind it all, and who's purchasing the studies, who's buying the scientists. Bear in mind, there are very few independent scientists these days. They're always looking out for money to come in, and that comes in from certain studies that want to be either proven or disproven. But generally, when the research goes the wrong way, that research doesn't come out. You picked up an interesting history there about the margarine, for example, and there was a specific history that the seed oil industry did a great job of discrediting the use of saturated fats like butters and milks that we've been using for millennia, and then convinced us that cholesterol was really, really bad for us, and that unsaturated fats were really, really bad, really, really good for us. And that's kind of come full circle now with regards to things like fats, for example. Keeping fats to a modest amount is always good within the diet. So it's always good to get both sides. And I tend to sit on the fence unless there's something that's really clear and says, okay, here we can see that there is a good reason behind it, and that's what the evidence provides us with. And you've got to look at the source of that evidence and make decisions based upon that. But bearing in mind, everything's all about making as much money as you can these days. And most of the people who are pushing the products want to make as much money as possible. And that's where you have to sit back and look where the sources of the money that's coming from for these particular studies.
Question we've been asking in this first half hour: probiotics, research out there suggesting they could be quite useless. Are they quite useless, or are they quite useful to you? Akash thinks that probiotics are very necessary in our day-to-day life, and they do work well on our bodies. Many of the diseases that we suffer today have their origin in the intestine and are caused by an imbalance of the intestinal flora. According to the most recent research I have read, says Akash, probiotics, benign bacteria present in supplements and dairy foods, can be effective in the prevention and treatment of numerous diseases such as diarrhea, obesity and cancer. So those are the thoughts of Akash.
Well, I mean, there may be a couple of points there. Certainly gut bacteria in cancer, there's very little research to support that at all. Now, when we talk about bacteria as such and the good bacteria, generally what they do is they compete against bad bacteria. I made the distinction about lactobacillus, which you tend to find in your yogurt products and other dairy products, which are generally quite good. There's nothing wrong with having them. But you can have certain unfavorable states from having too much bacteria. I've seen people that consumed large amounts of fermented foods and dairy products that had lots of beneficial bacteria, and these produce lots of lactic acid. Now, against the competing bacteria, the so-called bad bacteria, this lactic acid shuts down the ability of the other bacteria to work. So it's good to a degree. But then everything is like context, and it depends, right? Mm. So there are certain amounts that are favorable of each and every compound within the area that we live in. And so to say that bacteria are useful is true, because we need certain bacteria. Kids in a dirtier environment tend to have stronger immune systems. But there's a school of thought of whether we keep our system working as well as we can, and the immune system is something we have to fall back on, or we keep using lots of bacteria, and that's that's the kind of modern thinking at the moment, but it's not necessarily correct, and we're still finding our way through. Is it we need to keep our system working as well as we can, or we have lots of competing bacteria doing the job? So my personal view with probiotics is they can be useful. I think keeping gut bacteria to a minimum, so there's relatively so-called good bacteria, diminished bad bacteria, but there's a lot of emphasis also on hormones keeping us functioning as well as we can as well. And a lot of gut problems can stem from hormone problems. They can also stem from environmental pollutants. They can come from certain foods that just aren't being grown as much as they are anymore, as well as they were before. So probiotics are probably a factor, but they're not a clear remedy for absolutely everything.
Devas, thank you very much indeed to you for your text as well. Talking probiotics, we're going to talk coconut oil in just a few moments' time, and a couple of the other stories that are doing the rounds with with regards to specific ingredients or certain products that are said to be good for your health. We had that one just before the news there, Keith, about the difference between pro and prebiotics. I don't know what the difference is, but you're going to tell us what that is.
Well, the pre means the feeding for the bacteria, and then the probiotics are the actual bacteria themselves. Again, there's a lot of emphasis on these products, and us. The supplement industry is a billion, tens of billion dollar industry, and there's a lot of emphasis on what supplements that we need. I generally believe that we can get a lot of the bacterial changes from the foods that we eat. So it's up to you. That there is a lot of people that have to have their supplements, and there are a lot of people that can get by just pretty well without supplements as well.
Is there an element of, and I don't want, I'm sure there are chronic cases out there, and I don't want to belittle that for a moment, but when you talk about that, is there the element of the sort of placebo effect that you've got used to taking it and you felt a little bit better and therefore it needs to be in the fridge the whole time?
Yeah, I think you've got to look at that from the honeymoon perspective, is how does it keep working over time?
Right.
It's a bit like trying that initial diet. You lost loads of weight on that great diet, but then every time you go back and use it again, you don't seem to have the same effects again, because there are certain other factors that need to be kind of factored into the equation. I think, usually when we see or take supplements, we've gone to see someone, and there are multiple other strings of advice that have gone along with that. So we need to kind of really kind of be quite critical about what's actually working and what are the mechanisms behind it.
This one's from Sarah. She's texted in with regards to our shout out about probiotics. Do they work? And Sarah comes back with a simple one, saying they have helped my brother who has Crohn's disease. I don't know if there's any link in between that and everything, but I suppose each their own as well.
Well, Crohn's disease, there's been some mixed research on Crohn's disease. And if you want to go and look at specific research and meta-analysis, groups of analysis of different studies, the Cochrane report has doctors peer-reviewed journals on the efficacy of most things that are studied. And Crohn's, there's been some mixed reports. Again, usually with probiotics, for example, as long as you're keeping some of the disease or pathogenic bacteria down, there's no reason why some of the beneficial bacteria can't be helpful. But then sometimes you can just go along to your average yogurt or some fermented foods that you can add in as a condiment and have that on an irregular basis rather than taking every single day. You can still get the same effects.
This one's from Ollie. They help me a lot. I've got IBS and often feel sick after I eat. My doctor suggested I take probiotics. They don't eliminate stomach problems for me if I eat one of my trigger foods, but they take the edge off a bit. And Eric's also been in touch saying, I drink kefir. It tastes decent. That's all I really care about.
Well, you can't argue with that. Food, for food, right? I mean, if you're going to eat food, you're going to eat stuff that tastes nice. There's no point in eating something that you really dislike taking.
But on that point, I mean, kefir, I mean, unless Eric is a little strange, kefir in its purest of forms doesn't taste that nice. And that's the whole point, isn't it? That you think you're taking on something that doesn't taste nice, so it must be good for you. And yet there are so many flavoured kefirs now. Is that, taking away from from what could be the benefits of that?
And you see the same with like kombucha and things like that, other fermented foods. It's like it's just trying to appeal to a broad market so more people take it in. I think again, with any kind of bacterial stuff, even fermented foods, we know that people have consumed fermented foods for many thousands of years.
Yeah.
But there are certain areas in the world where fermented food is actually associated with gastrointestinal cancers. Now, before people kind of criticize and say, well, you're saying that about all fermented foods, I'm not. But fermented foods were used as a condiment, and they're also used during kind of cold weathers to make sure that food lasted throughout the winter. And they weren't necessarily consumed throughout the whole year round. And that's why we need to look at foods. And sometimes we're getting the problems. You're the person who texted in about the IBS, for example. He has a trigger food. Well, rather than take the probiotics, don't eat the trigger food.
Mm.
There are certain things that are going to make people's digestive system worse. And there are lots of mechanisms behind why people have bad stomachs. For example, serotonin, which is a neurotransmitter, is produced mainly in the stomach. Now, serotonin and histamine, when you eat foods that irritate the bowel, you'll produce more serotonin and more histamine, and you'll get more states like IBS and irritable bowel and stomach cramps and a lot of other things. So there are foods that we know that kind of create this response. So maybe we need to get a bit clever about the foods that we're eating that limit this response, rather than keep trying to take something that decreases another response that we have a better control on.
We've seen the rise of all sorts of diets, of lifestyles, and of course buzzwords. Paleo has been one of them in recent years. Well, this one won't come as a great piece of research for those. I just want to move this on to another. That a number of people will have in their condiment cabinets at home. Maybe you are an advocate of, maybe use it on a daily basis. Harvard professor Dr. Karen Michaels has recently, speaking at the University of Freiburg over in Germany, suggested that coconut oil contains damagingly high amounts of saturated fatty acids. Her lecture, Coconut Oil and Other Nutritional Errors, went viral on YouTube. You can catch it there if you want to have a look at it in full, and has raised doubts about the so-called superfood. She described coconut oil as pure poison and one of the worst things you can eat. I think it's fair to say she wasn't exactly pulling her punches when it came to coconut oil.
I think from that argument, she's using some very big buzzwords, and I think her argument is very prone to bias and flawed thinking herself, despite her being a professor, which doesn't necessarily negate her from making mistakes. And if you look at the word toxic, for example, you can apply that to many different compounds. And as you know, Paracelsus, the well-known chemist, said, it's the dose that makes the poison. If you go and eat large amounts of something that has a negative effect, it's going to create a response. But even if you look at the unsaturated fats, like your vegetable oils, which were called the heart healthy oils, as soon as you heat them, for example, they become very toxic to the human body. And that's, we all know that eating lots of fried food is bad for our health. But actually, when you heat coconut oil, because it's saturated fat, even at higher temperatures, it remains relatively stable and doesn't create the damaging compounds that you get when you heat the vegetable oil. So it's dietary fat that we know that people who eat large amounts of dietary fat are prone to metabolic syndrome, to insulin sensitivity reductions, and other heart disease related factors. So the thing is, with fat, you need to eat moderate amounts of fat. There's plenty of studies that show whether it's saturated or unsaturated, that they will accumulate in the liver and create a toxic response. And actually, the research that I've seen is that your vegetable oils and your soy oils, they actually become more toxic in the liver at lower doses than the saturated fats. But it's like context, and it depends how active you are, for example.
You use the word context there, and Joe, it's crucial, I suppose, to keep this in context, because whilst it's easy to make claims like that during a lecture over in Germany, having flown in for that particular lecture as well, these are sort of claims that could have massive impacts on cultures, but also agricultural businesses the world over. I think India were very quick to sort of respond to this, weren't they?
They were indeed. They have the Indian Agricultural Ministry have fired back and sent a strongly worded letter to the Dean of Harvard School of Public Health, asking them to retract the statement and suggesting there's no scientific evidence to prove coconut consumption is linked to heart disease. But again, this is something that went viral on social media. So you also have to look at the impact of social media and the naysayers and everyone jumping on that viral video.
But equally, there are parts of the world, such as India, Keith, where coconut oil is a dietary staple, isn't it?
Yeah, and if you look at the hotter areas, the more tropical areas, the reason why the fats tend to be saturated is because they're stable in hot weathers. So when you start to consume these fats that aren't unsaturated, we know that like a lot of seed oils go relatively rancid, even at room temperature. That's why some of them have to be kept in the fridge. Now, you take that and then put it in the human body at 37 degrees in a good, healthy person, then some of these oils are already creating some of the compounds that create the damage. So I think, I looked at that and I thought that to use the word toxic is relatively silly, because there are many compounds, you could sign is toxic, and you can get that in things like nuts, almond nuts, and loads of other foods. And if you eat them at relatively high amounts, there was a few studies where, not even studies, there's things in the news. You type into Google and you look at cassava poisoning. When you haven't cooked cassava properly, that's toxic, and that's killed a lot of people. So we need to have a relatively balanced head when we use the word toxic in foods, because as I said, it is the dose that makes the poison. But when it comes back to fat again, moderate amounts of fat within the diet, between 10 and 30%, seems to be useful for most people.
Coconut oil is what we're talking about this very moment with our special guest, Keith Littlewood, who's in studio. He's wrapped into a couple of the stories that are doing the rounds at the moment with regards to, Well, just a couple of question marks around just how good certain foodstuffs are for us. There has been this damning report from one Harvard professor about just how good coconut oil is for us at the moment. And this flies in the face of many who swear by its benefits. It's fated as a healthy choice, but the oil, which is high in saturated fat, is called by the Harvard professor as one of the worst things you can eat. In fact, going as far to say it is pure poison, using terms like that, as we have just suggested, as a number of people are texting in at the moment, can be dangerous. Surely you have to choose your words more carefully. Or is this something that's just been lost in translation? Because as you said, the majority of this lecture was given in German, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I enjoyed translating it this
Good.
Morning.
You're just working on it at the moment. We have to be careful with the way we use words, though, don't we?
Yeah, and I think we were talking off air about a letter perhaps being fired back saying, well, where's the research that supports this? Now, if she's looking at high amounts and saying, when you consume very, very large amounts of this, it becomes toxic, then you can literally apply that to everything. If you drink 6 litres of water, that's toxic and you'll probably die.
Yeah.
If you breathe in too much oxygen, that's toxic and you'll die. So there's a kind of there'll be a certain amount where everything becomes toxic. So it's a silly word to use. When you use saturated fats in the right amount, they're great. They contain cholesterol. It means the liver doesn't have to produce as much cholesterol. If you consume too much of that, it can become problematic. So I think we need to dial back on some of these words, unless there's actually real facts behind it. And I know with coconut oil, because it's something I've been recommending with clients for at least 10 years now, that it's a very safe fat to use.
It's multi-purpose as well, by the looks of things. This one's from Finn. Love the show. I love all things coconut, milk, cream, water, etc. This one from Editor. Swear by coconut oil. I wonder who funded the research and how much the professor got paid to state these claims. Very naughty, says Editor. And I like this one from one of our listeners. My friend has a dog who is around 7 years old and was suffering from some kidney issues. Not sure if this one was meant for Helen Farmer in the afternoons with the pet section yesterday. But she goes on to say, the vets swore the dog was coming to the end of its life until my friend started adding small amounts of coconut oil into the dog's food. The dog made a miraculous recovery. Has been living in a healthy, happy state since. The dog's 9 years old now.
So. Well, you know, there's a few studies that they used to feed animals coconut oil and they stopped doing it because it made them too lean and muscular. But when they fed the animals the unsaturated vegetable fats, they started accumulating more fat. And generally, from if you want to sell more meat and get more money for your pounder when the animal gets slaughtered, that was a good way to make animals fatter, because coconut oil is actually pro-metabolic and it helps to enhance thyroid function to a degree in the right amounts.
Wow. Right, I know what I'm doing this evening when I feed the dogs, that's for sure. Loading up as well and see what the difference was. I'll report back with research for you in a couple of weeks' time.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.